As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for joining us this week on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell. With us today, Liam Tharm is here, Mark Kerry is here, and a returning old friend, Jay Harris as well. Hi,
thank
Jay.
You very much. Whenever I come on this pod, I feel like I've made it. Do you know what I mean?
Nice.
No, it's tactics, right? So it means I must actually know like a tiny bit of what I'm talking about.
we'll see. I think you came on to talk to us about running stats.
Yeah.
Of years ago, that was an interesting episode. If I sound somewhat deferential when I'm addressing Jay today, the context there for the listener is that Jay and I play football together on Sundays in JSF Plumbing and Heating League 4, and Jay wears the armband for Ribblesdale Rovers. So, you know, he's the one that talks to the ref a lot, should be said.
On behalf of you.
No, he's well behaved. It's others that that get in trouble, and I try to mediate.
The idea for the episode today is for this podcast to give an overview of specialist coaching roles and a few in other areas as well within the Premier League in particular. So a bit of a one-stop shop to explain that the various different roles that have sprung up, particularly over the last 5 years or so. Mark will be talking primary functions. It just felt like an interesting time to give everyone an idea of just the breadth of roles now within Premier League clubs.
Yeah, especially when the international break has been on, we've sort of broadened our focus a little bit. And I got a piece out this week based on mentality performance coaches, and specifically rather than sports psychology or maybe clinical psychology, where we're talking more specifically about mental health issues or disorders. I did a piece that was talking more about how you can use that mentality on the pitch and how you can really focus your performance on pitch, whether it is doing more things in the training ground or maybe, you know, in the classroom, so to speak, of trying to think of the ways that you can improve your mentality and focus. So we thought, let's broaden that out and speak about other specialty coaches.
Liam, broadly, why has there been such a rise in specialist coaches?
Well, we've spoken on the pod quite a lot, to be honest, about the shift from management to coaching, primarily obviously a name change of a role, but how that sort of shifted from coaches themselves are more specialist coaches than ever because they are now just working on stuff on coaching, on the training pitch. Moving away from now, you've then got specialists in every department. So you've got specialist sports scientists, specialist analysts, whether that's video, data, recruitment. The whole idea is that everything now is as specialist as they come because everyone wants experts, because with experts you get more knowledge, you get better performance, you get a greater ability to sustain doing well or improving. And partly because you need that to keep challenging at the top because it gets harder to win things and clubs want more success and more money.
Jay, you cover Brentford for The Athletic, a club that in my eyes have been almost addicted to specialist coaches, right? This is a club that is keen to be at the cutting edge when it comes to player development and specialist coaching roles, some of them quite unique at Brentford, in order to support that.
Yeah, and like with most good things that have happened to Brentford in the last decade, it all comes down to Matthew Benham. And ever since he became majority owner in June 2012, he's tried to take a wider overview of how to improve football. And obviously the transfer recruitment that everybody knows about is one example of that. But when Brentford were in the Championship, they had one of the lowest budgets in the division. So they got to think of creative ways to improve the quality of their squad. So one way they decided to do that was by hiring all these various and random specialist coaches to improve the quality of the players they already had at their disposal. So the best example, and I actually spoke to this gentleman last week, this guy called Bartek. I'm not even going to try and pronounce his surname, but he's a ball striking coach. And Bartek's whole point is that you're never properly taught, and there's no systematic method in place to teach players how to strike a ball. So he's talking about how it's really easy to work with someone on their free kick technique, on their penalty technique, on their corner taking technique, from open play shooting, and see like quite a quick uplift. Then obviously everybody knows about Thomas Gronemark, the throwing coach who had great success in Liverpool, but actually he comes from Denmark and he was doing work with Midtjylland, and Midtjylland were Brentford's sister club. So Brentford tried to do that, and just think of ways of scoring from long throw-ins. And if anybody can remember Brentford's first game in the Premier League, that 2-0 win over Arsenal, the second goal comes from a long throw-in. So it's just trying to find these tiny advantages from looking at things in a different way.
Jay, so nearly said marginal gains there. And there's something that I wanted to... Bash is probably the wrong word as a bit, but it's something that gets a little bit misappropriated. That the entire reason why I think things like these work really well is because you look at the proportion of goals that come from set pieces, or ball striking is every single time a player's kicking a ball. That happens a lot. Mm. So improving that incrementally is going to really, really add up. But the phrase gets sort of thrown about a lot now in football, coming from cycling, from Team GB, Team Sky, with Sir Dave Brailsford. Their whole thing of marginal gains was everything they did away from the track or the velodrome. So taking mattresses and pillows with them so players, their cyclists, sorry, could sleep comfortably. I think they molded the chairs on the team coach to their posture. So when they travel, it was, you know, even down to hand washing, it's stuff that like we look at and people go, that's ridiculous. If football do that, it's like games gone. What are you doing, sort of thing? But the point was, that was everything away from it. The whole reason what we're talking about here is stuff that's on the pitch. And I just get, I think it's a bugbear for me when people are like, oh, this is a marginal gain. And I'm like, it's not. And it's good that it's not, because this is how you get significant, you know, improvements in all the different phases of the game, so to speak.
Okay, let's try and explain and give some detail into some of the roles that currently exist across the Premier League. One, Liam, in particular, that I've seen spring up more specifically in the last 12 months or so would be what is called coach analyst. What is coach analyst, and why is coach analyst?
Yeah, it's kind of the technical side of like almost like a wing back type role. If you want to look at it like that, it's half coach, it's half analyst. So principally, the whole idea is that you part of the on field staff. So you'll do, you know, some form of coaching, whether that be on the pitch, it might be delivering, you know, video sessions in an analysis room, but you're directly working with the players, you're doing any form of coaching, and you're also part of the analysis team, whether that be coding, putting together presentations, looking at the data. There's an argument that this is just sort of putting a label on the idea of upskilling coaches in terms of their ability with technology, or upskilling analysts in terms of being able to actually work with players. I'm not suggesting that the wheel has been reinvented here, but it's the idea, I think, of formalizing actually what was maybe more looser sort of terms before. And it's manifest into really interesting ways. And Mark and I were actually at the Opta Forum last week and was really fortunate, had the honour of leading a panel on this topic with some really interesting guys. Jonathan Hill, who works really closely with Scott Parker, has followed him across clubs as his coach analyst, if you like, which speaks to the importance of that, of having someone that can work that closely with you and gets you. I know you all know this, Ali, but people have seen the clip of Bournemouth's promotion game where Scott Parker gives a very emotional halftime team talk. And I was asking Jonathan about this. They show some video clips in the background. And one of the things that Jonathan says is he already knows how Scott's looking at the game, what he wants to see, so he can clip stuff during the game. Mm. Scott's not got to say, tag this, tag that. He's already clipped it. So when you go in to give that halftime team talk, the video might not be the most important part, but he's got those three or four examples that he can show. And it just sort of feeds into that, you know, as an analyst, a lot of what you do is away from the pitch, but it's that chance to then have an impact in the game and try and change something.
I think as much as anything, the clubs who do employ a coach analyst, and I think the same is true of all of the, you know, the people that we're going to speak about, is having that environment and creating that environment to allow the players and the coaching staff to be open, to allow these sorts of things to be more creative, and then you start to get more solutions off the back of it. And I think it speaks to, like what Jay said about Brentford, kind of having more of a long-term vision. I think a lot of clubs naturally are thinking far more short-term. They're thinking about the game at the weekend, the next couple of games. They're not thinking in terms of years ahead. And I think that employing, you know, a coach analyst, but as I say, all these other specialist coaching roles, actually is fairly cost-efficient. You can, you know, even if you were to part with a six-figure salary or even just below that for, you know, any of these roles, they would be very pleased with that sort of, you know, number to earn that per year. Yet it would still be low compared to, you know, your average squad player. So I think that having those that investment over a long period will get you the benefit. I was almost going to say marginal gain, but it will get you that benefit over, you know, short, medium and long term, if only the club was to sort of have that buy-in and that environment that's set, I think.
Absolute environment of fear that Liam Tharm is
Mark should have been in a fight as well with the size difference, I hope. It's also a case now with the analysis that so much data is publicly available, so much video is available that clubs can pay for, you know, organisations to do that for them, that analysts now don't need to be the ones doing all the coding. You can outsource that if you need to. Now it's about actually saying you're not there to make the data or make the video. You're there to help implement it and actually make it actionable. That's the, you know, entire point of it now.
Well, because there was a period where you'd often hear about friction between those who are dealing with, engaging with and talking about statistics and numbers, and those often labelled sort of on the grass, proper football types. And that gap, I guess, has been pretty consistently bridged over the last few years in order to make those conversations a bit more normal and therefore more effective and more impactful. Set piece coaches feel like they've got pretty good PR at the moment. There's quite a few of them across the league. Brentford have hired most of them at some point. Brentford are really good at set pieces. And now all the top teams have them. And now all the top teams are really good at set pieces as well.
Yeah, well, this is what I think is interesting as well, where, you know, a lot like the analytics movement, I think if the really top teams are doing it, then everyone starts to really pay attention. I mean, Jay will be able to speak more about how Brentford have been doing it for years. But I think that, you know, if Arsenal and Manchester City are doing it and they're being as successful as they are this season, then everyone else, it's cascading down a little bit more now to be like, okay, well, we definitely need to be doing that as well. So there's a massive ripple effect as a consequence, I think.
Do you think there's going to be a point where there's too much demand and not enough supply? And, you know, as with any new role, Liam's shaking his head, but in my eyes, as with any relatively new role, which is going to necessitate experience, a portfolio, a body of work to prove that you are an expert in these fields, if suddenly everyone's like, well, we need one of these, where are they, Liam?
Well, I mean, probably one of the clearest examples I can give that Liam speaks about Brighton Claxon, but Nick Stanley, who is the Brighton set piece coach slash analyst, he was formerly a first-team analyst and moved across into that role. So right. I guess the whole point is that you have people with diversified skill sets. A lot of these people we're speaking about have not got professional playing backgrounds, but will have university backgrounds. So I know Nick Stanley's got a master's, for instance, in performance analysis. So it's the idea of having people that not so just think differently, but you've got wider ways of looking at things. So that way, and people will see that as like to challenge or sort of disagree, but it's just the idea of avoiding groupthink, I guess, really, that you don't want everyone looking at it the same way. Broader perspectives, yeah, so that way you can encapsulate really everything and you hopefully ensure that you don't miss any details.
I think one final thing I'd say on it is that people think that by having more set piece coaches, you are going to be scoring more goals as a consequence. But I think it works both ways. It works from an attacking perspective and a defensive perspective. And I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but my understanding is that there actually hasn't been at the league level, if we're talking Premier League, an increase in set piece goals scored. It's been fairly stable over time because the set piece coaches and the wider group of set piece coaches are just as good at stopping the goals as scoring them.
Jay, when you're watching Brentford games, how much or how often do you think to yourself, that's a new routine? They've had to, you know, it makes sense to establish routines to become more effective, but then there's going to be a certain point where you have to turn those over in order to stay fresh.
Yeah, all the time. I remember I first started noticing something funky was going on in the first season I covered the club, because Bernardo Cueva, who I think his profile's grown over the last few years, and obviously he's going to be moving to head up Chelsea set piece department in the summer. But at the time, not really many people knew who he was. And he'd always just kind of appear on the edge of the technical area, making all of these random signals. And I just kind of went back through Wyscout and watched what they were doing. But one really good example, which I actually think me and Liam were speaking about a couple of weeks ago, is from the Arsenal game when they lose 2-1. So all of Brentford's players who were in the box, I think there were, if I've got this right, 8 players in Arsenal's box, 2 on the edge of the box, and all 8 players start in the 6-yard box around Aaron Ramsdale. And then as Janot's preparing to take the corner, they disperse and move to different places. And then what happens is Christian Norgaard basically makes a run, blocks off a player, and Ivan Toney gets a free header and should probably score. And that's the whole innovation of these coaches, right? You're trying to, it's basically a game of subterfuge. Can you trick the opponent into thinking this is the routine you're doing. This is the actual routine you're doing. A lot of short corner routines to improve the angle of the delivery and things like that. It's hard to stay across. And I'm sure we've all seen it before. You'll often see set piece coaches from the two different teams kind of all making these random angry signals at the same time. But it's something fresh. It's something different. And obviously, Bernardo Cueva is so good at his job that he's got this opportunity at a bigger team.
Well, what would the future hold, I hear you all ask. And I find this fascinating, right? Liverpool and Google DeepMind have developed a full artificial intelligence system called Tactical AI, which can advise coaches on corner kicks. So this is going to be the next step. Your computer steps into the technical area, my computer steps into the technical area. And yeah, they're trying it on a three-year sort of collaboration. Stay tuned for more, but they've got essentially a tactics assistant that predicts the best way to take a corner, and I think this is going to cascade into
Harry Redknapp was right.
Should quickly actually say, because obviously we're talking about set pieces, we've not given any numbers, so I've got it in front of me here. So since August 2021, when Brentford were promoted to the Premier League, they've scored 43 goals from set pieces. But actually, if you look into it deeper, I think Mark was the one who told me this, to be fair. The XG figure is about 5.3 goals per 100 set pieces, and only Everton have a better record. And if you're a team like Brentford, where you're coming up into the Premier League for the first time, you've got one of the lowest budgets in the division, that makes a huge difference to your chances of staying in the Premier League or not.
For sure. We've mentioned Thomas Gronemark. He's obviously been a pioneer in throw-in coaching and improving that aspect of football. A lot of throw-ins in every football match. Liam, I've heard restarts coach. Is that sort of amalgamation of all this sort of stuff?
Yeah, it's entirely how you want to sort of group it. I mean, a lot of set-piece coaches will generally just do free kicks and corners because that's, you know, the most likely to result in goals. Some of them will include like long throws within that, but restarts you can include kickoffs. Goal kicks. Mm. Obviously now, famously, in this international break, have become a viable source of goals, and also Bournemouth when they were doing it for a period of time. So it just, most people want goals because it's a cheaper way than it is for paying for really expensive players to score goals. But yeah, it will just depend sort of club to club.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
I mean, that's set piece situations, dead ball situations, repeatable situations. What about open play, Liam? How much has that been broken down? There's an article from The Telegraph in 2016 that talked about the FA trying to implement specific in-possession and out-of-possession lead coaches. In fact, one of them from that sort of era, Richie Kyle, who led the FA's out-of-possession program, is Rob Edwards, assistant manager at Luton.
Mm. Yeah, this is something I think Dan Ashworth's massively credited with as part of the changing, you know, entire setup of England from top to bottom in terms of the coaching process, is having two coaches sort of per team or per age group. I definitely know it's a thing now at academy level where one will focus on the in possession, one will focus on the out of possession. So that way you're just halving the workload of a coach. So it's not to necessarily like just make their job easier, but by giving them fewer things to focus on, they can go more into depth. Mm-hmm. And often they'll sort of switch those roles across the season. It's not permanently sort of fixed in place. But a lot of the roots of analysis are the fact that there's a very sort of famous paper from 1983, and there's more papers that have followed that up since, that basically got a group of coaches to sit down in a room. It showed them a half or a period of a game of football and then got them to try and recall as many events as possible. And the successful recall rate in this initial paper in the 80s, I think, was 42%, which is pretty bad given you think if you're then acting on what you remember, most of the things you either misremember or you get them wrong. So analysis came in as a concept to be like, we need to help reinforce what the coach is thinking. And, you know, it's generally it was getting data to quote unquote back up the coach and sort of support what you're seeing. So now the idea, I guess, is improve analysis, improve everything around them, but also we can get coaches now who have fewer things to focus on. And then we can get a specialist coach who might be really good at coaching a defensive setup. So you might get coaches who historically have coached really good counter-attacking teams, and you could say, okay, well, we'd get you in because you're going to coach a really good low block. You know all the details. Maybe you were a defender. And likewise, you get coaches now in the Premier League that can coach a really good attack and not a good defence. Not naming any names, but there's people that might fit certain categories better than the others.
Well, can I just quickly say, do most teams kind of split the responsibilities? So I know, for example, that what tends to happen is, I think it's Thomas Frank and Brentford's head of coaching, Justin Cochrane, mainly look after the attackers. And then Thomas Frank's assistant, Klaus Norgaard, and Kevin O'Connor look after the defensive side. Do you think that's just a Brentford thing, or do you think most teams will probably split it like that?
Yeah, I imagine most teams split it to a certain degree, and it probably depends on the like, especially the minute at a pro level, what they played as a player. But I know that is a reason why, because you want to lean into what your strengths were when you were playing, and certain coaches now will look to recruit assistants or alternative coaches based on what they played as, because if you were a central midfielder or a centre-back, you're going to know fewer things about being a striker, but you can coach, you know, team to build up a bit better.
Talking of former players, Benny McCarthy's in at Old Trafford. Is he attacking coach, striker coach?
Guess, yeah, depends how you want to term that. But yes, same kind of principle what we were saying, basically. And I know Ten Hag spoke about this, saying that Mark and I did a big piece on Marcus Rashford last season, who I know he's not quite been at the same level this season, but was really resurgent after Benny McCarthy came in and scored a lot of goals that you'd put down as a more traditional number nine, not always the winger cutting in. Yeah, on the basis that Ten Hag said, look, I wasn't a striker. My staff in their playing days weren't strikers, so I might as well get in an expert on striking.
And yeah, it must be said that this isn't necessarily a new thing, and where managers will bring in former players to come and help with the set of strikers or whatever it may be. But I think a little bit more kind of nuanced and new is an attacking coach isn't necessarily too much of a new thing. I think historically a lot of clubs have brought in maybe former players to come and work with the strikers. But I think what's probably a little bit more new in the area is sort of individual striker coaches. And one person I spoke to fairly recently was Scott Chickleday. He's currently a coach at Aston Villa women's side, but he's worked a lot on an individual level with the likes of Ollie Watkins at Aston Villa, Harvey Elliott at Liverpool, and historically worked with Harry Kane at Tottenham. But he discusses things like body position and body orientation. And I think as much as anything from chatting to him, it was really interesting to hear that a lot of clubs will do kind of finishing practice, maybe, you know, for 15 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is. But it's everyone is doing the same sort of practice. Maybe it's bouncing it off a coach and then sort of finishing first time or whatever. But Ollie Watkins might need to work on his left foot. Harvey Elliott might need to work on his right foot. You know, someone might need to work on their heading a little bit more. And having those individual striker coaches to be a little bit more nuanced in what they need to sort of improve upon is, I think, it surprises me that at the elite level, it's not actually worked on quite as much. And I think with all of this specialist, you know, coach, these specialist coaches that we're speaking about, I think as much as anything, it's done at the club level, yes, at a squad level sometimes, but I think the one-to-one element is really interesting to say, like a personal trainer, really, what does that specific person need to work on? Not necessarily what does this team need to work on? And this individual striker coach is a really good example of that.
I find it interesting that you brought up Ollie Watkins there, because one of my recent takes, I'm not even sure if it's a hot take, is that Ollie Watkins is, in pure player development terms, the biggest and most interesting success story in English football over the last decade. Now, naturally, this is because of where he came from. A lot of elite players have been in, for example, Manchester City's academy their whole career, and Phil Foden, so you don't get that sense of journey to quite the same extent. But with Watkins to go from Exeter to Brentford to Aston Villa in England to now be considered one of the best number nines in the Premier League and therefore the world, but also to have started out as a left winger, to have played on the right wing for Brentford, to have been converted into a striker at Brentford, and then almost a different type of striker now at Aston Villa and thriving in so many different ways. It really is the most incredible player development story. And we're talking about specialist coaches here, and you talk about people like Scott Chickleday, who's worked with him, Brentford FC having taken him on for a few years, and the importance that they place on developing the players that they have. As much as they win credit for their recruitment chops, I think their player development is what gets overlooked sometimes as having been amazing. And even way back where he started at Exeter City, who in EFL terms are a leading light when it comes to the focus on developing local academy talent, finding loans for them when they're too young to play for the first team, as they did with Watkins, who played for Weston Supermare, I think, and then Exeter. It's quite a nice thing to bring up as part of this conversation, because you start to see how, as much as it is down to the individual and the most incredible set of mental and physical and technical skill that he has had, some of the things that have helped him along the way.
Yeah, definitely. I think you have to give him a lot of credit, because there'll be players who would have been given and afforded the same opportunities that haven't taken them in the way that he has. So obviously, Ollie's done some work with Scott Chickleday. He also did some work with the ball striking coach that I mentioned earlier. Brentford used to have this mindset performance coach, which I think we'll probably touch on a little bit more in a moment. And Ollie worked with him. So it was probably like the perfect marriage, Ollie and Brentford, because you've got a club who are willing to try and do different things with a player who's just willing to accept all the help that he can get. I remember somebody at Brentford mentioned to me a couple of years ago that why wouldn't you invest in coaches? Because the vast majority of the time players spend on the training ground. We get so fixated on what happens in 90 minutes on a Saturday. They actually forget that the bulk of their work is done on the training ground. So why would you not put more time into making that the best learning environment it could possibly be?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
So Liam's had to take his leave from us, but Jay and Mark can take us to the finish line here. Mark, you've just done a big old bit of work titled How Mental Performance Coaching is Transforming Elite Football. Ollie Watkins, part of this conversation with some of the coaches that he's worked with at Brentford and I dare say at Aston Villa as well. Why did you want to write this piece? And why do you think it's such an important thing to bring up when there is still so much focus on the technical aspect of the game?
Yeah, I mean, it was a passion project of mine. I've got a background in psychology, so I kind of wanted to bring the two together when it was a little bit quieter with the international break. So,
Dr. Mark.
Let's move on from that. So I wanted to speak to actual professionals and experts within that sort of sphere. So that's kind of the reason why I wanted to do it. But then the more I started to speak with people, the more I realized it is an undervalued part of the game. And obviously, we talk about tactics, and I'm a data analyst. I'm focusing on objective things. But I think, you know, at odds with that is the fact that you realize these are people who are just, you know, young people as well, who are just trying to work out how best they can play the game. And I think that psychological element isn't as valued as it should be. So seeing that there was this growing world of psychologist coaches, mental performance coaches, whatever you want to call them, really, really sort of piqued my interest. And as I say, it's detaching it from maybe the clinical psychologists, where we're talking about problematic things, maybe like addiction, depression, anxiety. That's maybe more for those sorts of psychiatrists and professionals in a different sense. But this idea of sort of having it more geared towards what is going on the pitch and maximizing your performance on the pitch really interests me. And from the people that I was speaking to, I spoke to Dr. Dan Abrahams, Mark Bowden, Steve Silas, all of whom are experts in the field. I spoke with Chris O'Hare as well, who's a psychologist coach at Villarreal Academy. I think that's similar to the coach analyst role. He's out there on the grass and trying to work things out as well. I thought that was hugely interesting. But the first three that I mentioned are kind of working with Premier League players on an individual basis and occasionally working with clubs as well. a few of whom have been in the Premier League. So each of these people was sort of speaking about how, from a technical perspective, you're playing at the Premier League level. Everyone who's playing in the Premier League level is technically proficient, but yet you find players who come in and out of form. So why is that? Is it because they've suddenly got worse at football? No, it's clearly going to be that psychological element, that performance element. So that's the sort of the main things that they work upon. And speaking with Mark Bowden, he was saying that he was speaking with Reece Nelson when he was at Feyenoord on loan from Arsenal, and he was sort of struggling for form, and his numbers showed as much. I think he'd only had one assist just after the new year, and he was working with him, and he got 6 or 7 assists in the second half of the season and helped Feyenoord to a European final that season. So I just find it hugely interesting that it's something that is going on in the game. But the more I spoke with these people, the more I realised it was, you know, very much in its embryonic stages. And I know then from speaking with people in the office about it that Jay's spoken to people who have, you know, are mindset coaches as well. And they've obviously worked with Brentford because everyone has.
Yeah, I think, I spoke to Jack Burnell, who's a former Olympic swimmer. Open water swimming, though. So, they're swimming in the sea and stuff. as opposed to a local pond. But I think that the whole idea of it was that, players are very emotional. Loads of things happen in a game. You react in different ways. And it's almost trying to teach players how to control their emotions in that moment. So I think the example Jack gave me was that if a player misses a chance, is that going to impact the next chance that he gets? Is he just going to be thinking about that opportunity? You know, you it is cliche, but you do hear a lot of strikers talking about it on Match of the Day or on commentary, that those elite strikers have the ability to just forget about the chance they've missed and make sure they bury the next one. And I think it's just about helping some players. You get some players that, you know, maybe respond very negatively to a firm tackle and allow the opposition defender to kind of get in their minds a little bit. How do you teach someone to ignore that and not get riled up and not get drawn into a little bit of a confrontation? So I think that's what they're looking into. And again, it's just where you try and think, is there any tiny advantage we can get from these scenarios and improve players?
Do you know if he's free on Sundays, Jay? Because there's a couple of things that really resonated there, both for me and some of our teammates as well.
I won't lie, it's definitely given me a few lessons.
I think what you said there, Jay, was really interesting, though, in terms of the people I was speaking to were focusing on how much it is about education and learning and knowing that knowledge is power, such that if you're doing things on the training ground and having that repetition and that application, then when you come to obviously taking to the field on a weekend, you can put it into practice. And, you know, I won't go too much down the psychology route, but again, the people I was speaking to were saying about specific areas of the brain. So the amygdala is a very specific area of the brain that is sort of your emotional regulation center. And yes, under the stresses of thousands of people shouting at you, that's going to be going off quite a lot. You know, misplace a pass, that's going to be going off even more. So the idea is that we're not trying to sort of remove that part of your brain, but trying to engage more of what's called the prefrontal cortex, which is the, you know, the area that's essentially more to do with decision making. You want that to be kind of lighting up more than your amygdala, and it's trying to sort of weigh up all of those things within your brain and putting it into practice on the training ground with education, with application, that'll then help you with your performance on a match day.
If I could just say quickly, I don't know if Ivan Toney works with mindset performance coaches or ever has done, but he's obviously often pointed out as a player who's very good under pressure. I think the perfect example of that was, it's his first start for England and he takes that penalty he scores it and doesn't even flinch. And also, I also thought it's quite cool that Jude Bellingham threw him the ball immediately. It's a bit like, you know, of course you're going to do this. But there'll be other people who want to say, I want to try and get to that level of mental confidence and assurance in my own abilities. But that's kind of like the perfect example of somebody who is kind of at the top of their game in that regard and can cut out all of the noise surrounding them and just perform in that moment.
One of the quotes in the piece, this one was from Dr. Dan Abrahams, that I found particularly interesting, is he talked, Mark, about working with coaches on being less authoritarian and more player-centered. And this is interesting because a broad overarching theme of some of our discussions on the podcast for the last few years are how automated some top-level teams look now, how robotic in some ways. And you can understand that, on the one hand, in order to be able to take on so much information, tactical information and instruction, and execute it in these high-pressure environments, that would be a serious mental ability for a football player to have. But Dr. Abrahams' point is, he's saying you want players to be able to problem solve on the pitch as well, when you're not holding their hand, when you're not telling them what to do. And to develop leaders, he says, you need to give players opportunities to experience leadership, and that comes from good session design, exploiting huddles between activities, water breaks, getting players to talk more on the training pitch and asking them to find solutions to the tasks you've set them in your activities. I thought that was quite an interesting aspect. And then I just want to touch on one of the top comments on your piece, actually, by someone called Peter P. Peter says, I wish more commentators, players and coaches would talk openly about this. These psychological aspects of the game he's talking about are tactics as much as formations on the field, perhaps even more so. I think that's interesting because I do think the way that players and managers talk about the game is still a lot about mentality. It's still quite a lot about non-technical and tactical aspects, albeit that has become a bigger part of the discourse around the game as well. But when he talks about he wishes more commentators, and I suppose he might even mean people like us and colleagues of ours, it's very difficult from the outside to, and it's also fraught with issues, for a commentator to be making assumptions about what's happening or not inside a player's head at any given time. You do get former pros who will give their insight on when I played and that situation came to pass. This is how I felt in the moment, positively or negatively. And that is great insight that an ex-pro is able to give. But I guess I wanted to say, from a non-former player's perspective, I find it really difficult if I'm covering a game or trying to analyze a game. I almost avoid talking about things that I am essentially guessing about what a player thought in that, or any mental weakness. Fans are always keen to point out why their team collapsed or bottled it, or they're not strong enough, the backbone mentality. But it's a difficult area to get into, Jay, when you're writing about a team's performance. Sometimes that stuff can be just retroactively stuck on a team. It might not be fair.
I think sometimes it's just an easy excuse for a team's bad performance to say that they weren't up for it, that they were bottle jobs. And like you've just said, the reality is there's probably a lot more nuance to it. I don't rarely use the term, if I've ever used the term in my copy, to say that a team's bottled it, because there's just so much more going on that we don't know about.
And I guess an aspect of this whole conversation is, as you alluded to, Mark, this part of the game is very hard to measure. With set pieces, it is a lot easier to measure performance, certainly team performance. When it comes to mental performance, psychological aspects of the game, what does constitute success in this space?
Yeah, I think it's can be subjective, and I think that's okay, because we're talking about the psychological performance, which in itself is subjective. So I think sometimes it can just be kind of anecdotal that, you know, within a club you've seen a tangible improvement within the individual or within the environment. You can go a little bit more objective and use the Reece Nelson example that I gave, where before maybe he's dealt with this performance coach, mental performance coach, his output on the pitch, his numbers, his assists, whatever, were lower, and now they may be higher. But in the piece, another example that I thought was really interesting was kind of the body language of one of the central defenders, who initially was a little bit negative, shall we say, wasn't being as sort of commanding and bringing the line higher when they needed to sort of be a leader. And they were looking at kind of video evidence of, over a course of the period of time, were they doing that more? Could we see it in their behavior, in their physical actions, using their arms, using their hands, using their voice to be more of a leader? That's another one as well. And I think to kind of wrap up this side of it with the psychological side, another reason I think that this is a growing field, and as you mentioned, there's maybe a change generationally from a pundit's perspective, is that I think it's reflective of society as well, that there's a greater interest, understanding, education, knowledge on psychology in general. We're learning more and more about it all the time, about the brain, whether it's through brain imaging or more sort of subjective methods. This is something that's improving all the time, and now it's also cascading into football.
And then, Jay, there's a ton of physical expertise as well that goes towards keeping an athlete's body at its, you know, tip-top condition. Brentford at the forefront of this. I'm thinking sleep, I'm thinking nutrition. They got it all covered.
Yeah, the sleep expert that they have is called Anna West, and she did an interview with the Training Ground Guru a few years ago, and there are a couple of lines in there that really jumped out to me. And one of them was, she was talking about, in society, in our culture, we've got this idea that the person that can still perform even though they've not had much sleep is kind of like the elite individual. And she said it's just rubbish. You know, people need to make sure that they sleep to recover properly. And I think she spoke about the increase in injury if you don't get the correct amount of sleep. Yeah. And also just for players to decompress, because sometimes, and one of the examples she uses is that if a player plays a game late at night, not going to be expected to fall asleep the second that they get in through the door. They've got to kind of adjust their body accordingly. They're going to play games at 12 p.m. in the afternoon. They're going to play games at 8 p.m. at night. There's so many things that their body has to adjust to. So kind of monitoring the quality of their sleep is a good way of doing that. And then when it comes to nutrition experts, I think, you know, we've all heard stories over the years, right? Especially when it comes to Antonio Conte banning ketchup and doing all these things and making it, even throwing it all the way back to Arsene Wenger about chicken, fish, throwing away other foods like steak and ale pies or whatever it is.
But Mars bars.
From my understanding, what it is now is that a lot of players have personalised nutrition. Mm-hmm. So I know, for example, Brian Mbeumo has his own personal chef. I think that's what we're seeing players do more and more and more, because everybody's bodies are a little bit different. Everybody has different tastes and dislikes. So why would you not try and help them fuel in the best way for them, right? I'm pretty certain it's Declan Rice who always has the same meal, but I can't now. Yeah. I'm on the spot. I can't remember what that meal.
I think you're right though about that specific kind of tailored thing. I think that's maybe what's changed a little bit. Where I know from seeing like Ian Wright interviews where he said when Arsene Wenger came in, it didn't quite get the buy-in because he was just trying to change it, but not necessarily give the reason as to why. But now, you know. So the example that I've got is that Mona Nemmer was recruited from Bayern Munich, and she's now sort of the head of nutrition at Liverpool. And yes, there's loads of people who are, you know, as we mentioned before, are leading on nutrition at different clubs. But for example, she offers one-to-one consultations with these players, and she provides these cooking lessons to the players and their families as well, and tries to sort of cascade it. And I think maybe in more of the modern day, it's more the buy-in from these players to try and be the best they can be, which I think is probably a little bit more different from generations gone by.
Yeah, I've just got a random example for you, because there's stuff about the Lionesses and what they eat before games. So just to give you like an idea of how varied people decide to fuel their body. So Beth Mead has an omelette most mornings with peppers, spinach, mushrooms, tomato, and a little bit of cheese. Alessia Russo has porridge and sometimes has beans on toast. And then Nikita Paris goes for spaghetti bolognese. So it's just you players want to kind of have the option to eat what suits them best. Whereas if it was just carte blanche, all you're having is fish and rice, fish and rice, fish and rice, fish and rice every day.
It's funny you say that. I mean, Declan Rice's meal, we're all thinking it. And it is sea bass and rice.
Yeah, there you go.
Regardless of what the
nominative
kickoff time
determinism
may be.
For Declan, isn't it?
That's shoveling in sea bass at 8 a.m. before an early kickoff.
That's it. I remember he said it, no matter what the time was, he'd always have that.
Lastly, Mark, a specialist position that got a lot of coverage and things have gone a little bit quiet on. This is the substitute coach. Now, Sammy Lander is the name to bring up. He worked with AFC Wimbledon for about 9 months or so, a couple of seasons ago. And while he worked there, there was quite a lot of buzz, quite a lot of coverage in the mainstream media about this, and understandably so. A substitute coach was new. It was the sort of thing that would confuse some people. They would turn their nose up at it. A lot of other people would read the sorts of stuff that he was doing and think, yes, this does make sense. Teams can now make 5 substitutions. They can change half their outfield players. The end of games are arguably the most important parts of games as well. So why would you not have someone dedicated to maximizing the performance of your substitutes? But Sammy Lander only worked for Wimbledon for 9 months or so. And as far as I know, there aren't any other dedicated substitute coaches at this moment in time. So it doesn't seem like it's really caught fire.
No, I'm not entirely sure why. I think it's, again, I'm so reluctant to say marginal gains. Now Liam's got it in my head. But it is just having those sort of small incremental benefits that you could maybe use. And I think that this was a good example of one. I don't know how successful it was. And similarly, I don't know how necessarily they quantified success. But I think, again, if nothing else, it's having that buy-in, that open-mindedness, creating that environment to say, okay, well, this is something we're going to try. It might not always work, but we're going to try it. And again, Brentford are a really good example of that. But in general, I think that having, even if it's not having a dedicated coach, having that, reframing that mindset, and again, I think we've spoken about it on this podcast, where the rugby coach, Eddie Jones, has reframed it from talking about substitutes to finishers. The US women's national team coach, World Cup winning coach, Jill Ellis, has said that she refers to players on the bench as game changers and not reserves or substitutes or whatever it may be. So even something as simple as that could be maybe the difference. But then if you're also able to have a dedicated coach, and I know from reading the stuff that Sam Yolande has done, is just, you know, actually physically getting them to touch the ball quite a
right.
lot. Normally you just run up and down the sideline.
I think that's what I find personally more interesting than relabeling them yeah. to make them feel better and go into it with more confidence. I think we can all kind of understand that. But like the work that Sam Yolande was doing at halftime in a match, he would have the substitutes, the outfielders in particular, doing the sorts of drills that A, were geared towards them getting ready physically if they were called upon, whenever that was going to be, but also doing specific drills that were relevant to what they may do when they get on the pitch. Now, we all have been at games where it seems like at halftime, one set of subs are just whazzing balls at each other, like taking cool touches with their back heel, flicking up and volleying it back to their mate. It looks great,
it's
fun.
Very vibes only, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not hard to think, well, surely there's a better way of doing it. And I'm sure that in reality, Premier League clubs are doing more at halftime. But those two ends of the spectrum, I know which I would rather my team be focusing on. So I wonder if that's something that we may see a little bit more of in the coming years. I asked you guys on Twitter if there were any other roles you could think of. Tom mentioned something that Jay mentioned earlier as well, a head of coaching role. So Tom said, as in a coach who coaches the coaches, which is a phrase that I enjoyed. But I also think this is almost a sort of management role to an extent. It's, you know, it's as much about organization and delegation logistics than anything else.
Yeah, and sporting director could probably be sort of included within that in terms of overseeing what the wider coaching team would be involved with.
And Alfie was not the only one to bring up ref analyst. Well, hey. So thank you for listening to this. Thank you to Jay, to Mark, to Liam as well. We've tried to give an overview into some of the specialist roles that exist at elite level football right now. What else did we miss? I'm sure there's a few roles that we may not have flagged up. You can comment on the Athletic app on the podcast page. There is a specific comment section for each episode. We love hearing from you on there. And make sure you sign up to the Athletic today to read Mark's big piece from this week. It's wonderful work. Liam and Jay's work as well. theathletic.com/tactics, the place to go for a discount on an annual subscription. And make sure you join us next week when Michael Cox will be back with us on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.